this month's eBiomedicine podcast. My name is Julie Stacey, editor-in-chief of the journal, and with me today I have Justin Reeks from the Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory in Berkeley, California, and Peter Robinson from the Jackson Lab for Genomic Medicine in Farmington, Connecticut. They are here to talk about their new paper entitled Generalizable Long COVID Subtypes, Findings from the NIH M3C and Recover Programs, which can be found online in the January issue of eBiomedicine. Welcome to you both.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
So before we dive into your new study, perhaps you could touch briefly on your previous EBM paper. In that first study, your team used the human phenotype ontology framework to characterize the very complex condition of long COVID. How did that first work help you get started on defining long COVID subtypes in the new study? Peter, do you want to take this one?
Sure. My group developed the human phenotype ontology. I'll just say HPO for now, in 2007 and published it in 2008. And so for the last 15 years, we've been developing the HPO together with over several hundred clinicians as a tool for computationally analyzing the signs and symptoms of human disease. And maybe it helps just to say, why is it necessary to have an ontology and what is an ontology? So an ontology is sort of like a dictionary, but the entries are connected to each other in a semantic network. And each of the entries of this ontology describes one specific sign or symptom of disease. So for instance, headache or cough or fever. And the HPO has become standard for genetics and pediatrics, and it's used all across the world. So there are 20 translations. Thanks to the contributions of hundreds of clinicians and users, the HPO now has 16,000 or so entries, each of which describes a certain abnormality. And the reason why people use this is that it allows you to computationally analyze the match between the signs and symptoms that your patient has and a database of diseases. And so, you know, how does a doctor make a diagnosis? Well, sometimes you get the gestalt. So imagine you see a child with Down syndrome. Many of us would just instinctively realize that, oh, the child has Down syndrome, because we've seen this gestalt, this overall picture, so many times. But there are 20,000 rare diseases, and so nobody has that amount of knowledge about all of these diseases. And so what clinicians do is to write down the individual signs and symptoms, and there are very many of them in rare disease, and search for matches in various databases. And what we did with the HPO is to enable fuzzy specificity weighted matching. And so we'll go on to explain that in the context of the long COVID paper. So essentially we had this resource that, we've been working on for 15 years and there's lots of software, and we thought maybe we can use this to analyze COVID. And so the first thing we did was to go out to the medical literature about COVID, or actually about long COVID, and to say, well, what are all of the signs and symptoms of long COVID? And we found a total of 287, I think. Of those, 240 were already in the HPO. So it's very comprehensive, but about 30 were things that we hadn't entered yet. Some of them are fairly specific for long COVID, such as COVID toe, which was a new term. But that's what we did in that paper. It was basically just cataloging the signs and symptoms of long COVID. And this allows now findings from studies to be exchanged, and it allows computational analysis of long COVID.
Nice. That's a really nice introduction. And I'll segue right to Justin, who will ask him, how did you guys go about defining clusters in the most recent paper, and what types of information did you use to do that?
Yeah. So our main source of information was the National COVID Cohort Collaborative, or N3C. This is a project that harmonizes EHR data, electronic health record data, basically medical records from 77 different hospital systems. So it currently has about 22 billion rows of data. So it's a massive trove. And so we focused on a subset of patients for which we had data called UO9.9 patients. This is a label that's given to patients who were sat in front of a doctor and the doctor confirmed that they actually had long COVID. Mm-hmm. And so that was the main source of all the signs and symptoms of long COVID. And so we considered only the ones that Peter just discussed. There's 287 features that basically define long COVID. And we used the human phenotype ontology, the data structure that Peter just described, that, as he said, describes basically all the signs and symptoms of every known human disease. And the advantage there is, so we extract all the data from the EHR, and then we can compare them in kind of a fuzzy matching way. And so, for example, cough is frequently seen in long COVID patients, and shortness of breath is too. Those aren't exactly the same thing, but they both involve lungs. And so through semantic similarity, we can sort of get a floating point number, an exact measurement of how similar each of the signs and symptoms for each long COVID patient is.
Nice. And then once you were able to start mapping these phenotypes, what kinds of patterns emerged?
Essentially, what the procedure does is to measure the pairwise similarity between all patients. And a cluster consists of a group of patients that each of whom is basically more similar to other patients in the cluster than to patients outside of the cluster. And so this is a form of machine learning. We call it unsupervised machine learning. Basically, it learns patterns from data. And we began with on the order of 2,500 patients that, as Justin said, had been diagnosed with long COVID on the basis of this ICD code. And the unsupervised machine learning identified six clusters, and they differed with respect to the distribution of HPO terms, basically the distribution of clinical features. And to make this easily comprehensible, we summarized this on the basis of groupings of features. And so we looked especially at lab values, at neurology, at pulmonology, lung, at pain features, at cardiovascular features, abdominal features, and there was one sort of lonely feature, vertigo, mm-hmm. basically dizziness. Mm-hmm. And so doing that, the six clusters showed characteristic combinations of findings. And so cluster one represented a severely affected group of patients who had a relatively high prevalence of features from all of these categories. Cluster two was characterized predominantly by lung, by pulmonary features. Cluster three by neuropsychiatric features. Cluster four by cardiovascular features, heart and blood vessels. Cluster five by pain and fatigue. Cluster six was similar to cluster one, except the lab findings were largely absent. And I should say that the lab findings weren't sort of random lab findings. I mean, there are thousands of lab tests that we use in medicine, but the clustering procedure identified laboratory abnormalities that in other studies had been shown to be markers of severe long COVID. And so based on the fact that people in cluster one had these lab findings known to be associated with severe COVID and also had basically features from all of the organ systems, we think that cluster one represents the most severely affected group of COVID patients. Clusters two to four represent COVID patients that predominantly are affected in one organ system. So either lung, heart, brain, or pain and fatigue. I'm sorry, that's not really an organ system, but mm-hmm. cluster six, it's fascinating that they You know, they have similarly, they have features from many different organ systems, but they tend not to have these lab values. We might be getting to this question in a little bit later about, you know, what are these clusters associated with? But, you know, one of the important things was overall mortality. And that was much higher for cluster one than for cluster six and the other clusters. So it's a bit of a riddle why patients in cluster six have so many features, but tend to be more mildly affected. And so the, you know, apparently the machine learning picked up some patterns that somehow predict mortality, but even, you know, we spent a lot of time studying the results of that. We cannot actually tell you what that is.
This is for Peter. What do you feel are the main strengths of this kind of analysis? And then on the flip side, are there any caveats that we should mention?
Many, many groups have developed algorithms and approaches for clustering data. And, you know, the purpose for clustering, maybe we should just step back and say, why would you actually want to cluster patients? Mm-hmm. And so I think it's instructive to consider the example of breast cancer. And 50 years ago, every patient with breast cancer would essentially get the same kind of chemotherapy. And it, you know, worked reasonably well, but tons and tons of research have managed to subdivide that disease into subtypes, many of which respond very well to targeted treatment. And so even though we think that a disease is sort of one entity, in many cases, actually, there are many different subclasses of disease subcategories. This is something that many people call precision medicine. And the challenge of precision medicine is to actually find out what are these groups. And so the purpose of clustering is to use machine learning to try to discern groups without us as researchers saying, well, I think it's probably this, I think it's probably that. So we're really letting the data tell us. And so that's why we wanted to do clustering. The reason we chose to do it in this way was that we thought that this kind of semantic analysis might be generalizable. And you know, one of the problems with machine learning is that oftentimes a model that you develop in one hospital doesn't work that well in other hospitals. And this is sort of a very mathematical topic, but one of the causes is something called overfitting. And, you know, an ontology in a sense is a simplification of a very, very complex clinical world. And oftentimes by sort of leaving out the details of data, you reduce this overfitting and can get a procedure that actually is generalizable. Essentially, we're the first group to use this kind of semantic clustering to find groups in EHR data for long COVID. And we took the model that we developed in data center one. So we're not allowed to tell the names of the hospitals for privacy reasons, but we tested the model in five other data centers, so basically five other hospitals, and were basically asked, how likely is it that a patient from another hospital actually corresponds well to one of our original clusters in the first hospital? And we did a statistical approach to basically judge, you know, if we were just randomizing this, how often would we see our actual results by chance? And the answer was never. You know, p-value of 1 in 1,000 is a very conservative estimate. But if we'd done the permutation a million times, we still wouldn't have seen it because we were so far away from, you know, the randomized data. So that's the positive aspects. You asked about provisos, and there are many. So this is a computational project. So we didn't actually do a clinical study. The electronic healthcare record data is very noisy and incomplete. And until we actually are able to test this, it's not possible to say whether if we had as many patients in a clinical trial and you know, we were writing down their signs and symptoms in detail, we don't know if we would get the same results or maybe a different result or what. So there are a lot of provisos. And anytime you do a so-called retrospective study, so you're looking back in time, it's possible to fall a foul of, we say confounding factors. And I mean, these are basically things that basically make you make a mistake without noticing it, because the data are just very, very complicated. Mm-hmm. So these findings do need to be validated in the future in other studies. And that's, mm-hmm. that's part of our plans. I think the potential value of this general approach of using ontology terms, and using this kind of semantic matching, is that you get, a machine learning model that's actually easy to interpret. And so if you look at some of the figures in our paper, you know, you see the clinical features, you see how common they are in each cluster. So these are things that, you know, a doctor and a patient indeed can understand sort of in general terms. And so this is we feel more interpretable than many sort of black box machine learning methods. Mm-hmm. But, you know, so if you actually created a method like that in a hospital, in a prospective study, not in the EHR, but actually collecting these symptoms in detail, we do feel that this is the sort of thing that you could transfer to other hospitals and basically say, oh, you're in cluster 3. We're actually doing a clinical trial specifically for patients in cluster 3 because we think that this medication might work better for them. So that's the vision of precision medicine. We're not close to that. That's more of a medium term vision, but that's that was our motivation in doing this study.
That's a nice segue, Justin, for the question I had for you, which is how will these findings help patients? It sounds like you introduced that nicely, Peter. Do you want to add anything to that, Justin?
Well, I guess the dream is what Peter said. We consider this a first step towards precision medicine and you know, tailored treatments to people that are in each of these clusters. I think there's some value in and of itself, though, to just describe what long COVID is, you know, in the different subtypes, because so many people have long COVID. You know, it's important for people to understand what it is and, you know, that there are different types of this disease. So there's some value in that. But I think, as Peter said, the value here, the long-term plan is a first step towards precision medicine.
Peter, do you want to elaborate on what the next steps would be toward getting there? You mentioned clinical trials. Are you doing some prospective analyses on maybe biomarkers, or what's the next step?
Well, Our group is purely computational, so we do not take care of COVID patients ourselves. We're a part of a larger NIH project called RECOVER. So many people are working on that. And so this is essentially one of the things that they might choose to pursue in the future. In general, I think our contribution will be to continue to develop this methodology, to continue to improve it. There are many ways that one might improve the computer algorithms that led to this result, including taking more data into account, taking the time course into account computationally. We think that similar methods might be available for many of the questions that one has in clinical informatics, including predicting outcomes, understanding why some medications have sort of unwanted side effects in some patients. And so our plans for the coming period include applying similar methods and developing new methods to other aspects of the COVID disease. So we're very interested in psychiatric manifestations of COVID and in other work. We did showed essentially that there is an increased risk of being diagnosed with a psychiatric illness following COVID, but that this risk basically tapers off after about four to 6 months, which is good news, if you will. In unpublished work, we see that some of this risk is actually associated to phenotypic features that you can capture via HPO terms. Justin and I've had a very rich and, for me, rewarding collaboration on a series of topics surrounding COVID. And essentially, when you're doing this kind of computational work, you say, well, I've got this resource, I've got, you know, millions of patients. And if I can manage to assemble the data, cleanse the data, remove potential sources of error, and then apply the appropriate statistical test, you know, I can learn something new about the disease and association that essentially is a clue for future clinical studies. And so that's been very rewarding work.
Yeah. Well, that was really, really nice, guys. I think I'd like to wrap up always with a question about whether you'd like, if there's anything I missed, if there's anything else you'd like to say to our listeners.
Well, one general comment is, so Peter and I are big exponents of team science, and we've just been very encouraged by the experience of working on long COVID. It's kind of a silver lining of the pandemic is that the scientific community really became a lot, in my mind, a lot more collaborative. And Peter and I have collaborated with probably hundreds of scientists from, you know, a handful of countries, and we just hope we can continue the momentum. Mm-hmm. And I think the same sort of collaborative atmosphere can help with a lot of other diseases besides COVID.
Great. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. Once again, I have Justin Reese from Berkeley and Peter Robinson from the Jackson Lab with us today. Thank you again, guys.